Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 191, I chat with industry consultant Jeremy Kipnis about the past, present, and future of movies. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded January 23rd, 2014. Episode 191, The Past, Present, and Future of Movies. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek and Director of Content at AVSForum.com. This week's guest geek is Jeremy Kipnis, who is the founder of Kipnis Studios, a theater design company installation. Jeremy's also a recording engineer and a photographer, cinematographer, generally a Renaissance geek. Hey, Jeremy, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing great, thanks. How about yourself?
Very well this afternoon. Very wintry here on the East Coast.
Yes, you're in Connecticut, I believe, and it's probably snowing.
It was just a little while ago. We got about 11 inches.
Oh, man. And here I am in California, where it's probably about 80 degrees outside.
You see, now what are we doing inside right now instead of being outside where you are?
You know, it would be very nice if we were, but instead we're going to be in here talking about home theater geekery, and there's plenty of that to talk about. Now, before we get started, I want to make sure that everybody who's watching live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Jeremy as we go along, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So, Jeremy, your interest in music and audio and video and movies and so on is deeply ingrained in your family. Give us just a couple minutes of how that is.
Sure. Well, I grew up in a family of musicians, really, that goes back three generations. You know, in fact, all the way to the end of the 19th century, when my great-grandfather, Heniot Levy, came over from Poland to Chicago and worked with the Chicago Symphony, among others, and was a pianist in residence, as well as a representative of a piano company at that time called Velta Minion that used to make piano rolls, of course, at a time where there were no real records to speak of classical music that didn't sound like you were listening through a tin can.
Right.
And then my grandfather, Alexander, came directly after him and turned out to be a really incredible musician, an opera singer with a bass tone like Caruso had a tenor tone. So he was an internationally renowned opera star and went on six continents out of the seven and had a very extensive career. And of course, then there's my father, who is a harpsichordist and pianist, as well as being a raconteur. And
now, your father, by the way, your father is Igor Kipnis.
That's right.
Who I listened to for many, many years. A fine, fine harpsichordist. Really, really a beautiful player.
It was a great honor to be his son, and I only wish that he could have lived long enough to see what I've created here. But his inspiration, both in terms of music and also photography and movies, was spellbinding to me. So we can talk about that in some detail, as well as how I was influenced by my grandfather and my great-grandfather and other people that they knew.
Right. In fact, among the people that they knew was Ansel Adams, and you actually studied photography with Ansel Adams, for heaven's sakes.
Very, very briefly. My father was playing in Carmel, California, and it turns out that that's where Ansel Adams, as well as Clint Eastwood, took up residence. I guess it's very, very beautiful there, and they realized the value of buying property there. And I was lucky enough that Ansel Adams was also a harpsichord fan. So when I met him and told him that I was a photographer, he was kind enough to share a few pointers with me.
Oh, that's nice. That's how amazing for you to have at least shared a moment with the master.
It really is stunning when you bump into people along the way that you know and revere, and they're, you know, have celebrity status, but they turn out to be very genuine and have all kinds of pointers about how to deal with things that you never imagine, and usually that they never actually write down.
Right, Right, exactly. Well, among the things that I know we wanted to talk about today was sort of the inspiration of the movie business and how it has progressed over time. And I know that you've been inspired by the big screen experiences of the past, Cinerama and so on. Give us a little sense of history here.
Sure. Well, I was born in 1965. So, you know, comparatively, I went to the movies very, very young when my father would take me to places like Radio City Music Hall. And at one particular time in 1969, there was a very private showing of Fantasia, a movie from 1940 that was made by Disney and really one of the first commercial films to have a multi-channel soundtrack created specifically for the purposes of distribution. Of course, at the time, the United States was entering World War II, and there was a very great compulsory not to get involved with technologies that were not specifically for war. So the breakthrough of multi-channel sound in 1939 and 1940 in motion pictures really went dormant, even though that was a great film and made tremendous use of the format of seven channels that they actually pioneered for that motion picture. And it, right. And we wouldn't have surround sound until Cinerama in 1952, 11 years later.
Right. By the way, let me just interject a quick aside here. You were talking about your family and your grandparents and grandfather and great-grandfather and so on. I just want to make sure that I have a little connection here, too. In the movie Fantasia, you remember the scenes in between the animated pieces were members of the orchestra in silhouette, and Leopold Stokowski was, you know, dancing with Mickey and talking with him. And meanwhile, the orchestra was in silhouette. You remember that?
Absolutely.
Well, the orchestral score was recorded by the Philadelphia Symphony under the baton of Leopold Stokowski, but the musicians on the screen in silhouette were members of the L.A. Philharmonic because the movie was shot in L.A., which is where Disney was. And my grandfather was a member of the L.A. Philharmonic playing viola, and he is one of those guys in silhouette on that screen. So I just wanted to interject that real quick.
What a fabulous connection. So, of course, yeah. That movie is dear to your heart as it is to mine.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So then 11 years later, we get Cinerama, and we come back to surround sound.
That's right. As a part of the very first commercial widescreen attempts where general practice at that time and for the previous 20, 25 years was to have the last century's television aspect ratio of 4:3, or more technically 1.33:1. Right. Aspect ratio, essentially what's called the Academy aspect ratio. It's much more square than the widescreen you're seeing here, and certainly only half as wide as, or a little bit wider than that, than your typical scope movie, where it would be 2:39:1. So,
right, but 2.39:1 as opposed to 1.33:1. So we have a much wider aspect ratio. Cinerama was even wider than that, wasn't it?
Well, that's correct. At the time, they didn't have the technologies that we've seen in the last 40 years to deal with widescreen movies. So initially, they started with 3 35-millimeter cameras and projectors all lined up one next to the other, so that, in fact, you would have a little seam at the joining spot between those three images, but otherwise you would be getting three times the resolution and even more than you would with a conventional 35-millimeter film, even if it was just the one panel of the conventional 4:3 shape that was typical.
Right.
So suddenly people were introduced to widescreen out of nowhere, and it took off like wildfire. And every movie company in Hollywood immediately tried to seize on their own particular patent that they could exploit in order to have widescreen movies and attract people back from staying at home and watching television.
This brand new thing called television.
But as we know, there is a continued rivalry between wanting people to go out to the movies and spend money on tickets and popcorn and trying to keep them at home watching the advertising that comes along with all of their programs. And this duality probably will continue for a long time. But what's interesting to me, of course, is that it's the same Hollywood making these same products, even though the distribution chain, one goes to the theaters and one goes to the television at home.
I've always found that to be fascinating, that the same studios, Hollywood, in Hollywood, basically make content for both distribution channels, and they want people to do both. And so they try to offer something in the commercial cinema that you can't get at home. The greatest example of that that sort of didn't work, in my opinion, is 3D. You know, I mean, 3D has been around since the 50s and even before. But the most current incarnation with the polarized glasses, not those red, green, anaglyph weird glasses, started a resurgence in the 90s and early 2000s at the same time that 3D TVs were coming out for the home. And I kind of went, wait a second. I thought 3D would be something that they could attract people into the theaters, into the commercial cinemas with. But now they're able to do that at home almost at the same time. Weren't they shooting themselves in the foot?
Well, it's interesting that you bring this up, because 3D generally is perceived as a gimmick by most audiences. And it seems a shame when you consider the potential for the additional information that 3D could convey, both in the story, but also in particular, viscerally, you know, drawing you much, much more into the image if it's done correctly. But of course, there's the rub. And that's the rub that's been going back even to 1953, when some of the first widescreen 3D movies came out, right on the heels of Cinerama.
Right. I recall that.
And in spite of the perception most people have that those had the cyan and red glasses, they were in fact the polarized glasses that we use today, much in the same way as they are in the IMAX for the last 10 years, slightly different from the real D that we see at AMC and Regal movie theaters showing with Sony technology.
Right, right. Or IMAX, which uses a slightly different but very similar polarization technique.
That's right. I, of course, have been a fan of the active glasses, particularly the ones in the IMAX theater that they used to have back before the turn of the century.
Right.
Clearly, there is far less ghosting and other permutations that would take you out of the realm of fantasy, which is, of course, what we're trying to achieve, I think, when we go and watch a movie.
Right. Exactly. Now, for many, many years, most of the last 100 years, over 100 years, we've been using 35 millimeter film. But then Todd A.O. came up with, and some others, to use 70 millimeter.
That's right. The same people that were responsible for the Cinerama process ultimately funded the research and development that produced a much wider than 35 millimeter or 70 millimeter display format. So the 65 millimeter negative plus the 5 millimeters of magnetic sound formed the 70 millimeter roadshow format, really starting in 1956, thanks to then entrepreneur and inventor Michael Todd. So it was called Todd AO and sold to Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer so that they could have their widescreen process different from, example, from Paramount's, which was called VistaVision and used 35 millimeter film run sideways to have a larger area of negative and print, making a sharper image, of course.
Huh, interesting. I hadn't known that.
And, of course, once 70 millimeter film was a reality, thanks to Todd A.O., 10 years later, we would see the beginnings of IMAX, where it's the same 70 millimeter film, but it's run with 370 millimeter frames, making up a 4:3 or 1.33:1 again aspect ratio. So
now we've
come full circle.
We have. We're back to 1.33:1, and the IMAX screen is that aspect ratio, if I'm not mistaken, or is it not somewhat wider? I can't remember.
They call it 5:4, but the actual frame size, I believe, on the IMAX negative is still 1.33:1. And, of course, the sound is no longer on the film itself, but carried separately.
Right, right. Well, since then, of course, we've transitioned to digital. And I just wrote a story on AVS this week about how Paramount is the first studio to announce that it is no longer going to deliver films, canisters of film, to theaters. That their distribution to theaters is going to be only digital. And this, you know, may not make so much of a big difference because statistics I read said that only 8% of the 40,000 some screens in the United States have not made the conversion to digital. And also, this only applies to the distribution in the United States. Other markets around the world are still going to get film because the transition to digital has been much slower there. But in the United States, we have mostly digital now, and with a resolution of what's called 2K 2048 by 1080 or 4K 4096 by 2160 pixels. So talk to us a little bit about that transition.
Oh, God. Well, I think all the way back to the first computer applications with digital audio, there was the hope of having a speedy enough system to be able to capture, manipulate, and then display video in the same way, making it ultimately available to everyone, such as we have today. And from that standpoint, the motion picture industry has eagerly sought to eliminate film as a distribution medium as a whole because it's very expensive to produce. Now, you can still film a movie or a television program or even parts of a video game using 35 millimeter or 70 millimeter, which will probably never happen. But the point being to, you know, have the look and allure of film, but then once it's transferred to digital to be edited, it's also ready for distribution. And that takes no additional money except to really push a switch or have the file transferred over the internet or on a hard drive. So
yeah, exactly. I was told, the a film print, a single print of a film on cellulose film is like a couple thousand bucks, whereas a digital copy on a hard drive is like $100. Huge savings for the studios.
So there's no incentive to continue to distribute on film. And in fact, as many as 10 years ago, there were very specific plans laid out so that money could be made available to theaters that otherwise would not be able to make the capital investment to do that changeover. Obviously, right. If you have a multiplex, you might have to change 8 projectors or 12 or even 20. And with each digital projector costing upwards of $100,000 by the time you're finished, you know, outfitting it with a lens and input cards and that special hard drive, of course, that secures the movie and the copyright value and intellectual property rights of the people that own the movie, you know, you're looking at crazy money in comparison to just sticking with 35 millimeter film, which you already have a projector for, and really you just rent the prints. If nobody's going to rent you a print, you're out of luck. So essentially, digital was forced on the movie projection and movie theater business, whether they liked it or not. And while it was difficult initially, now I think we're starting to see some great consistency going in any particular chain from theater to theater, where if it's all digital and it's pretty much all the same technology, you wind up getting fairly consistent results, which sometimes are very good. But then the consistency falls apart, as it does with, you know, all business endeavors, when nobody actually pays attention finally to those lowly projectors that are just sitting and running 24 hours a day.
Right. And not only that, but the job of the projectionist goes away and has almost gone away. Late last year, I had on Thomas Larson on the show, who is the head projectionist at the Grauman's, or now TCL, Chinese Theater in Hollywood. And he talked about how most theaters these days don't have a projectionist anymore. It's all totally automatic.
You know, this brings up a very interesting point that I grew up with, and maybe other people in the viewing audience did as well, where there was a time where you didn't have CDs and you didn't have even video discs, laserdiscs or anything. You just had video cassettes. That was the only thing that you had at home. And if you were more interested in movies than VHS or beta, the best that you could hope to do would become a projectionist yourself, which is something I decided to do at our local Mark Twain Library. They had a little film program, and over the years, I became not only familiar with how to work with different film formats and project them all the way up to 70 millimeter, but at the same time, appreciate the value of putting together film programs where people come into a darkened room and sit together and experience the same drama visually and, of course, sonically. And that's a very different thing than happens today. I think most people who go to a darkened movie theater have looked around and seen lots of people playing with their phones. So there's no concentration in the same way there was before for the experience of motion pictures. And I know you'll agree again that so often it's much easier to just pull your phone out or your tablet or even your laptop and watch a movie there or a little bit here and a little bit there as you go along. And somehow even the best movies that have been made, it's like 2001 as an example, sort of fall apart when they're, one, seen in a very different context than they were intended, namely a small screen experience. And two, without the concentration of watching the entire film on a very large scale with a big sound system and a big, big wide screen that just takes up your entire view, it falls short of the expectation that the director had for the audience's experience.
Exactly right. J5JCH in the chat room is making a similar or a related point, which is that this transition to digital has been particularly hard on drive-in theaters due to the special needs they have, and many are going out of business. Now, I wouldn't call drive-in theaters the best possible cinematic experience, but they certainly are. I mean, I remember going to them as a kid.
Absolutely.
They're almost non-existent now. That is one sort of venue that I think we will see become extinct before too long.
Well, of course, there's always a nostalgia side to all of these different aging formats. For example, the LP. That seems right. Making its own comeback, and I know some people think it's because of sound quality, and others think it's because it's the vogue thing to do, and it's a big 12-inch format, which is, I think, lots of fun to hold and to look at the liner notes and whatnot. But unfortunately, I think we'll go the way of the dodo for most people because it's too much trouble to follow through on the tired old rituals of the past. And while they're fun and exciting, eventually they give way to the faster appeal and more the greater variety of programming and experience that one can have once you get away from linear playback. So instead of sitting there watching a whole movie, you can sit on your iPad and flip through anything in the course of an hour or two.
We may get to mobile applications a little later in the show, but I wanted to come back to the blurring of the line between commercial cinema and home theater, which you embody tremendously with digital projection in the home, same as digital projection in the theater, with surround sound in the home, same as surround sound in the theater. In fact, many of the people who commented on my piece about Paramount not shipping film anymore is that they said, who cares? I don't go out to the movies anyway. I watch it in my home and it's much better. And in many cases it is. They don't have people talking on their cell phones. The floors aren't sticky. you don't have a kid kicking the back of your seat. All kinds of things make viewing at home perhaps even preferable to going out to the movies. There is the social experience of going out to the movies, but let's lay that aside for the moment because I know that you're involved. Your current business endeavor is to design and install home theaters such that they provide the best possible experience in the home.
Well, that's right. To me, I've been seeing a convergence coming for many, many decades where computers and audio and video and how they're handled and captured as well as displayed all comes down to the same basic digital technology. It's just a matter of resolution when you get right down to it. And of course, here we are decades later with multi-channel sound, usually at 192 kilohertz and even 24 bits, particularly if it's a concert recording that shows up on a Blu-ray. So for less than the cost of a ticket to go to the live event, you might very well have a superior experience at home. If for no other reason, then you can see it again anytime you like and pause and pee anytime if you need it. So the advantage of going out then to a live event, I think, becomes vanishingly small, particularly when you have the issue of trying to pay for all the little constituencies that go on when you go out to an event.
Right. I mean,
even if you don't have dinner, you still have gas, maybe tolls. It's a large
parking event,
so you're going to have to buy things there. And it just doesn't last as long as going and watching something at home. And particularly now, where you don't have to even have a Blu-ray, you can just pull that information down from the cloud on any number of different services like Netflix or Vimeo or YouTube or I'm sure Vudu is one that comes to mind that has really excellent Blu-ray quality and sometimes multi-channel sound, just like you would get on the Blu-ray. Bit for bit the same if you have the bandwidth to receive it.
If you have that, there's the rub, as they say. There are plenty of people who would argue that, wait a second, streaming down from Netflix or Vudu or whatever is not going to give you the same quality as Blu-ray because they have to compress it more than it is compressed on Blu-ray, data compressed, so that it'll fit down the pipe. And you're saying that's not necessarily true?
Well, clearly there's two things going on. One is an increase in resolution, both audio and particularly video in the cases that we're talking about, where just 10 years ago, most people did not have access to 720p or even 1080i high definition unless they lived in a major city, because most of the software was not coming through cable and only a little bit of it was coming through satellite, maybe 5 or 10 channels, including HBO. So you would have to pay to experience the increase in resolution. But today, again, as I said, with the cloud being available, the real question is not can I get it in high definition or with multi-channel Dolby or DTS sound, but do I have the big enough pipe? Am I paying the premium in order to get the bandwidth necessary to always see the exact same thing as if I owned the disc itself in my library?
And I've heard you say that if you have enough bandwidth, Netflix, for example, can supply something that is bit for bit as good as Blu-ray. I don't know that I knew that.
Well, even before we started our interview, I know we were concerned that the methodology I was using to communicate via Skype video was in peril because we're doing it wirelessly and that, this is fraught with interference problems and variability in bandwidth and so on and so forth. But again, this is a science, just like going to the moon. And pretty much there's not a lot of confusion about how many bits of bandwidth it takes, for example, in order to pull a Blu-ray quality image down from the cloud, play it in real time. And you can tell what that is just by going to the Blu-ray and go to the information pane for your Blu-ray player while you're playing it, and it will tell you what the bandwidth is at any moment in time required to play that video along with the sound.
Right, and it's typically on the order of 30 megabits per second or more.
Correct. And what we have here at Kipnis Studios, not surprisingly, naturally it varies. Sometimes it's really bad because we're on a network with everyone else. And if it's a Saturday or Sunday, maybe it drops down to, just around that 30 or 20 during the mid-hour days. But at night, I can get as many as, 86 megabits a second, both up and down. And it seems kind of crazy, but that's what's available. That's what the technology offers. And I think that the real trouble is going to be in a little while, people are going to be charged on a bandwidth basis, just like they are on their phones.
Well, that could be a problem. Speaking of Kipnis Studios, I wanted to just spend a moment to show everybody your theater, which we can't really call it. I mean, we can call it a home theater because it's a theater and it's in your home. But because you're in the business of designing and selling home theaters, your theater is really more of a showroom, a staging area. You want to show clients what you can do for them. So a lot of times you have equipment coming in and out and so on. Still in all, it has been, your theater has been featured many, many times. And I believe was even in the Guinness Book of World Records in 2009. Was that right?
We've received a lot of Guinness World Records at this point. We're up to seven this year.
Oh my God.
2014. And of course, it's in Guinness's best interest to publish weird and sensational record breakers, like having the world's sharpest home theater or loudest home theater, or you know, the world's most complex video gaming setup. Or it's just a matter, I think, of what I'm doing reaches really for the stars. You know, just like there are some people that like to climb mountains, they want to climb Everest eventually. And to me, all of those great examples of Cinerama and 70 millimeter Todd AO and IMAX, they're things to aspire to in one's home, particularly now that digital allows everyone to have access to it. So admittedly, I started this very, very early on. Working with Sony in 1999 on their SXRD engine technology, which is featured first in their Qualia 004 front projector, and then later on in all of the cinema projectors all over the world that they have. So, and I'm grateful that I was able to see what 4K could offer so early on, when most people, again, were still watching NTSC in the United States, or, you know, PAL or CCAM in Europe, in the Far East.
In other words, standard definition.
Precisely. So it, when one considers that was on a DVD, 720 by 480, and here we are with high definition at 1080p, six times more information. Again, 4K is four times more information, again, than 1080p.
Right.
So it's difficult for people to conceive of how what they already just realized is better than standard definition, that it's worth jumping again on board to buy yet another television set. but something we were talking about the other day was if there are all of these people out there that use the 4K technology, the visual technology, display screens differently, then why shouldn't there be this you know, collective about using your desktop computer, your laptop, to communicate 4K to a monitor that sits right in front of you, maybe closer than you'd watch a movie, but still 4K.
Well, this is certainly one of the key arguments about 4K, which in the home is really 3840 pixels across by 2160 pixels down. It's a little less than the commercial version of 4K, but all the manufacturers use this term 4K interchangeably, so it's kind of hard to avoid. But when you're talking about resolution alone, just greater number of pixels, When you're looking at a 50 or a 60 or a 65 inch TV at a normal viewing distance of, say, 10 feet in most homes, you're not going to see the advantage of having those extra pixels because of the limitations of visual acuity. But if you put that same display 2 feet from you, as in a computer monitor, then you will see the advantage of the extra resolution. So that may be one way. We already know that a lot of people watch movies on their computers already, as you pointed out earlier, not only on their laptops and, I mean, yeah, laptops and tablets and so on, but on their computers as well. If they did that with a 4K monitor, of which there are many, that's one area where computer monitors have gone beyond TVs, is that they do have a higher resolution, can certainly, then that may be a big advantage there.
Well, I've been looking at this from the standpoint of the convergence of all these different technologies. So most people, not really thinking about it, have been shooting with their still cameras, even on their phones, at resolutions that are at 4K or even above. And they've probably not really ever seen all that resolution unless they made a printout, in which case, of course, the size of the image comes into question versus the number of pixels. So, and how far away somebody would actually hold that print in order to view it. But once we adopt the fashion of using all the digital devices together for the same purpose, it becomes obvious that you can take your still photo library that you already have amassed, play it back through your computer at 4K resolution on a 4K monitor, and see things like what we used to do with 35 millimeter slides, in a way which has not really happened before outside of, say, this lab or other places that had 4K for the last few years. And that's when you suddenly, step up to the plate and say, wow, 4K really does look significantly better than I'm used to seeing, even with this 1080p. And I'll give you an example. If you go into your Costco, anywhere in the United States, there should be a Toshiba 4K television in there for, I think, $38.95, $37.95. And it has a little demo that's still pictures. And admittedly, it's not watching a movie in 4K. And I know because that's what happens up on that screen. But at the end of the day, watching those still pictures will whet your appetite for what it is that you really have been missing in video presentation, even in high definition, which is that three-dimensional quality that we were talking about, but without the glasses being needed.
Yes, it does have a three-dimensional quality to it. It's not actual 3D or stereoscopic, but with the enhanced resolution, at least at a certain distance, it does add to the depth, the apparent depth of the image.
Of course, you know, from my standpoint, I've been lucky enough to be able to test 8K just a little bit here when projectors and cameras were made available for a day or two. And to see what 8K can do on the same size screen, where, again, we're increasing the pixel resolution, both of the capture and the replay, by a factor of 4. Well, again, as you pointed out, if you're not close enough to the screen, it really doesn't make any difference. But all of these formats were originally intended, as were 35mm and 70mm film, to be projected at a larger-than-life size. And part of the thing that really captivates me about cinematography, you know, and being a film enthusiast, is to see how different people use the language of photography and motion picture photography, cinematography, to express what the scene is about and what the characters are thinking and feeling and interacting. And if you look at really, really well done films, for example, not to keep jumping back 50 years, but Lawrence of Arabia or Thunderball are just great, great historic films now that have widescreen cinematography that is rare to see as well done today. And if you contrast that with television, like, for example, Lost 10 years ago, or Hawaii 5-0 today, basically the same film crew working in Hawaii, it's all very close up, handheld, in fast motion. It's not intended to be seen on a big screen, although honestly, when I watch it on the big screen, it feels like I'm watching a movie, not a TV show. And I think there's something to be said for that.
Interesting, because a number of people I know talk about digital presentation, getting back to the Paramount not shipping film anymore, and also high frame rate with The Hobbit is another example where people say, it doesn't look like I'm looking at a movie anymore. It looks like I'm looking at a TV show on the big screen. So kind of the opposite of what you just said.
Well, this is a good point to have a little departure as to where part of my research and development was going in this room as a test bed for myself, you know, to see what the limits of perception are. And of course, now a product that I can offer to a small handful of people that want to spend silly money, but really get that you are there experience out of their media, whatever that might be. And the lessons that have been learned there include the fact that in order to create a satisfying illusion of reality using artificial means like projected images and artificially deployed sound through speakers, there are certain rules that have to be followed. Otherwise, human beings are very sensitive to the differences between reality and the illusion as it's being presented. So one of the hopes, I think, of these filmmakers with the higher frame rate was that they would be able to include the audience by getting the screen out of the way. And the more frames that you have per second, of course, the less film judder there is. So that in combination with the increased resolution essentially is supposed to bridge the gap so you feel like you're looking through a very giant window at real people moving around, like it was a live stage play on the other side of the screen. My goal, of course, is to increase the apparent resolution of the picture and sound, not just by using very good sources, but by using very sophisticated technology that fills in the gaps very effectively and does so in a way that physiologically stimulates people who are watching here in this room and in my installations around the world so that they lose themselves in the illusion, something I call the mirage effect. And if you have more frames, it's supposed to look more realistic. That's not what I think is actually happening. And I'm very eager to speak with Doug Trumbull, who is engaged at 120 frames a second, twice over what the next Avatar film is supposed to be, which is 60 frames a second. Again, higher than 48 that we're seeing with The Hobbit.
Now, did you go and see The Hobbit, either of the two Hobbit movies at high frame rate?
Yes, I did. And to me, it looks kind of plastic in video.
I thought so in the first one more than in the second one. Did you see any difference between the two?
Yes, I believe that what's happened is that there's a certain amount of algorithm that's being added so that it has a more film-like quality rather than being so pure, like video. Video is a very fast frame rate format as a rule. And particularly if you look at the differences in the 1950s between what was then known as kinescope, where you would film off of a TV screen because they didn't have any videotape in order to preserve those programs, and you watch a film that was going to be shown on TV versus the video. I don't think I explained that very well, but the point is video looks like video, film looks like film. And so much of that is based on how many frames a second we're actually seeing. And the corollary is that in the last 4 years, TV manufacturers have tried to upsample whatever it was that you were watching in hopes that the added frames of information would make the image look more realistic, hence the refresh rates that we see of 60 hertz or 120 or 240 or even 600 hertz. But from my standpoint, that's artificial information being created after the fact. It's never going to look as good, nor is it going to follow the rules of the people that made the program as they expected the audience to appreciate it. And when Peter Jackson and others start making films with more frames per second, I'm excited to see what they're going to do, but I'm not convinced that it really makes a more enjoyable film, you know, as visual communication.
Right. Well, before we get too far into this, and there's more to talk about here, I do want to make sure that we see some of your theater. Now, we wondered about whether or not you might be able to pan your iPad around to show it, or we can show photos. What do you think would be the best way to go here?
More illustrative of what it was that was here at the time up until 2010 with the Trinity Theater, which is my beta level product line, essentially, you know, an almost no holds barred approach, but on a home level rather than on a large cinema level. So when you put up the pictures, we can go through them one at a time, and I'll just explain the sort of rationale behind why I did things the way that I did. Chose to, and how they differ from actual installations that I've done out in the world.
So here's a picture of the center channel array.
That, and I should say initially, all of these speakers, with the exception of the super tweeters, are the original THX Limited Music and Cinema Reference Loudspeaker System, which essentially was the first 5.1 design created by Tom Holman at THX Lucasfilm for George Lucas and THX in order to have a home playback system. So it was their reference benchmark. And that system consisted of one of these three center channels that you see here. Really two subs, like the two that you see there, but usually they would be vertically oriented, one for the left channel and one for the right. And if you go to one of the other pictures, you can see the tower that's designed to accompany one of those woofers, not the two that you see there. And essentially two of those towers, left and right, along with two of those subwoofers and the center channel, plus a diffuse pair of surrounds made up that $25,000 system, designed and first created in 1996 by Snell in Massachusetts. And it sold well for upscale music and home theater speaker system. And certainly it was mimicked and duplicated in a lot of ways. But I think that the important part was that the dispersion characteristics of the speakers worked well first and foremost for the controlled pattern that I need to produce intelligent dialogue on any of the channels, not just the dialogue channel and the surround channels. But what I found as I used that first system was that the surround channels that were diffuse didn't sound at all like the two front towers. And so the illusion was broken. And
exactly.
The same with
very, very important to have the surround sound field all the way from the side to the back to the front and all the way around be consistent in its tonal character.
Correct. As an audiophile recording engineer going all the way back to 1990 at Chesky Records, it was imperative, even with a two-channel recording, that you create, again, the illusion that you're listening to reality. That's not everybody's goal with recordings. But given a neutral set of speakers set up in a room which also does not contribute coloration, as most do, the results can be very convincing. But if any of the speakers are different, any of those channels not replayed by exactly the same components, the ear discriminates that difference very, very easily. And I believe it just takes you directly out of the program material. Whereas using identical drivers, and in this case, as you can see with that circle of amps, identical amplification, more than identical, on each and every channel. And to take the normal 5.1 that everybody is used to, or the 7.1, for example, and to re-articulate that instead in an 8-channel horizontal schema. So that means each of the adjacent channels is only 45 degrees apart, which allows for a singular presentation quality that is tonally accurate and holographically displayed. That is, the speakers disappear, and whatever the mix is in the recording appears free field around you as though you were there. Because of the added information that's accommodated by decoding with very, very sophisticated software, we're able to really fill in the blanks, even on something like an MP3 or a lossy program source, to the extent that most people are completely blown away. They've never heard anything that was so monumentally involving and immersive. And that's all of my design here.
Right. And what's amazing to me is that that system that we just saw some pictures of isn't even the very top of the line that you deal with. It's like the one tier down, right?
As I said, you know, there's always a higher mountain to climb.
People might want to climb Everest after all. That was only K2.
I like the idea of climbing mountains, but it has to be something that I'm familiar with, like electronics and presentation, physiology, and those different arts and sciences. But rather than just think of it in terms of a home theater, it's an experiment to me. And since the technology is always getting better, there's always that opportunity to come closer to my original conception years and years ago of what it would be like to own one of those giant Cinerama curved screens with the wall-to-wall picture and sound. Not too many people can afford a 500 or 1,000 person movie theater. And if you could, it'd be a very lonely place, I think, with that big, big screen and big empty room. So there's some disadvantages to actually spending those $6 million that I did here for the building, all of the speakers, all of the amplification, every little piece of AC power source and filtration. In fact, so much of the stuff here is NASA grade, simply because as an audiophile, I've realized that you can improve things by listening and correcting problems that otherwise exist, and most people would be completely amazed that you even can get 3D sound out of a speaker. So it really is a very, very different perspective than most people have from sitting down in their home theater, turning on the projector, and eating some popcorn and enjoying whatever they're interested in. To me, it should be a visceral experience, and if I can bring that to the next level, which would be from this size here, up to the cinema size, where you could have an audience of 400 or 500 people, like in an IMAX, but really lose them in the illusion that they're watching a movie. And IMAX certainly does a great job, but it's also technology that is mostly from 1969. And other than some slight bells and whistles, including 3D and some digital sound, it essentially is the same as it was at that time. And I look forward, of course, to their going all digital, because that could be really monumental.
This is an interesting point. RSX in the chat room is asking, "Wow, is that all Macintosh amplification?" And I believe it is, right?
The full complement when we had the 12.12 system, which includes the horizontal 8 channels that you see there, plus an array on the ceiling of 4 channels as well. So that brought us up to 12.12. That full system had 72 Macintosh amplifiers and an additional 24 Crown macro references to run the subs. So the total output of the room was, you know, that of some small towns.
You mentioned
because
something...
I'm crazy about getting the results as natural, realistic, and electronic as possible. Of course, the power supply for this room is very sophisticated and includes 2 separate feeds from the road, each of them 800 amperes.
Man. Well, all those amperes, at least the Macintoshes, are all tube-based. And I was going to ask you, you mentioned something about going all digital, and yet here you have these Macintosh tube amps. Do you still prefer the sound of tubes, or are you eventually going to end up with solid-state electronics, at least, if not Class D amps?
Well, I think that each of the different methodologies for amplifying audio signals have their particular colorations and characteristics. But, of course, it's possible with the right circuit to neutralize that and make a tube amplifier sound identical to a solid-state amplifier, and vice versa, as I believe was proved by Bob Carver back in the stereophile cross-examination, where he took his Carver amplifier and changed the output characteristics so that it mimicked Conrad Johnson, and was able to do it to the satisfaction blind of the stereophile staff. So assuming you put your faith in them, which I certainly do, I believe that it is possible to tune amplification to sound any particular way that you like. My goal, of course, is to have the amplifier be straight wire with gain, the way most engineers would perceive it. And the fact that tubes allow you to roll your own, if you will, and therefore change the characteristic of the tube and the way in which the circuit sees the tube, I can produce more power here for less money. And also, of course, have the benefit of a little bit of convection heating going on. But the point is, to make the solid state equivalent would have cost about 4 times as much in order to quadruple or octuple the circuitry in the same way as a very high-end Class D amplifier does. And it's this cross-matching and balancing of multiple identical circuit paths that eventually reduces the distortion, which I perceive as coloration.
Mm-hmm. The other thing you mentioned was you had up to a 12.12 system, 12 subwoofers and 12 main channels, 4 of which were overhead. And that seems to have foreshadowed the appearance of Dolby Atmos and Oro 3D, both of which have overhead speakers. And nowadays we're starting to talk about 3D sound, 3D audio systems with these overhead speakers in a truly hemispherical sound field. In commercial cinemas, you've done that in your home already.
I think we all were thinking the same thoughts, and it undoubtedly goes back to those pioneers of yore, such as Leopold Stokowski and the people at Disney, Fred Waller and company at Cinerama, who, among other things, would have liked to, I think, have had ceiling speakers and done a hemispherical sound system. But they were moving from mono at that time, or the occasional stereo test, really, but no commercial stereo, to surround sound in a way that leapfrogged, for example, from 480i DVD all the way to 4K. So my impression is that when you pull out all the stops, how would I put it? How would you put it, Majesty?
Well, I mean, you know, when you pull out all the stops, it sounds great. But certainly in the 40s, there were limitations to the technology, and Disney and company went far beyond them. But now we're only just starting to realize what they probably envisioned but couldn't do.
And like so many inventions, whether or not it's good or bad, is often perceived, commercially in a different light. For example, we've had multi-channel SACD and DVD audio as a high-resolution audio disc formats with multi-channel sound, and yet that is, in general, not embraced by most people. And the file downloads of those same recordings now being made available, for example, on HD tracks, surround sound is just not in the marketplace for most people, I think, when it comes to music. So the idea that, now we're going to start adding channels overhead, I think already is more threatening than what we had 10 years ago with just adding 5.1 to music playback. But as you know, I like my surround sound and I like it realistic. And height is an important part of a really, really sensitive sound mix. It's something that IMAX has been doing with their overhead channel, the 6.1 of their system, now for about 15 years. And everybody loves that sensation because if it's used effectively, it just elevates your sense of immersion rather than drawing you out of the presentation.
The same thing with Dolby Atmos and Oro 3D, the best examples of which I have heard, and they blow me away completely. They really do add to the sense of immersion, as you say. I've got a couple of questions from the chat room here I want to make sure I get in. WebFan1 wonders what kind of power conditioning you're using. Now, you mentioned you have some specific 800-amp feeds coming into your theater. Does that include power conditioning and some sort of UPS? I mean, you live in the East Coast. You could get power outages.
Oh, absolutely. No, we do have a generator here that actually covers us when the power disappears due to a nor'easter or a hurricane or something like that. So I'm well covered. And it's interesting from an experimental standpoint to see what the differences in presentation quality are, even though small, between filtering and balancing the line current from the road, from what everybody else is using, to being completely isolated, on your own propane generator.
And do you hear a big difference and see a big difference between those two?
There is. Even in a very sophisticated system like this, the fact that you are no longer connected to the grid means that you're no longer an antenna for all of the noise that's actually out there. And one of the most effective ways that I've found to eliminate that noise is to use solid core power cables. There's a bunch of different brands. I happen to like the Less Loss brand because I just reviewed it most recently, so it's my favorite. But essentially, what you want to do is filter out, using solid core technology, all of the high frequency noise above 60 hertz, which is the only fundamental tone that you're interested in coming from your AC wall socket. But perhaps more important even than the differences between the generator power, where we're completely off the grid and drawing power from noisy power from the road, is the ability to balance that power by using a balancing transformer after those 800 ampere transformers in order to eliminate any noise within the system here. So if one component were to output noise like a typical DAC or a Blu-ray player or something like that along its ground plane, normally that would contaminate the sound to some small degree on a high-end system. And you would notice the difference when you turned on and turned off even an extra Blu-ray or DVD player because it would add that much noise and hash back into your multi-channel sound system. But using the solid core technology, as well as the balancing technology we have here, essentially eliminates all of that noise. And you have pretty damn pure, clean power on the level of NASA, but that's still not the same as if it's coming from a generator or batteries.
Right. RSX in the chat room is asking if you've ever done any comparisons in 3D sound between what you've done, maybe Dolby Atmos or whatever, and the older Sansui QS or CBS Labs 4-channel. I think we're talking quadraphonic here. You must remember quadraphonic.
I do, and because my grandfather and my father were both musicians, of course, they reviewed for different magazines and periodicals, as I do, and they would get records that were just coming out. And starting in the late 60s, very early 70s, there were suddenly the spotty occurrence of quadraphonic discs, either SQ by Columbia CBS, I believe, or was it RCA, and QS by Sansui, two completely incompatible ways of encoding two additional channels in a two-channel playback format of an LP or a reel-to-reel tape. Not discrete, but certainly decodable, you know, in the same way as original Dolby Digital had multi-channel surround encoded into the original two-channel magnetic or optical track that was on the film.
Right. Well, in the remaining seconds we have, there's one question here that I was going to ask you as well from iPhone Kiki, which is, what would you recommend to assemble an affordable version of the system that we've been of the system, your system, and the systems we've been talking about that would still provide somewhat of an immersive experience?
Clearly, the major factors from my standpoint are having an image that's big enough in order to take up your front field of vision and really give you a chance to have some of your peripheral vision taken up by a part of what's going on visually on the screen. So I first recommend a big enough screen so that you can sit at least a screen width away, maybe a little bit closer, but that's me. I like Cinerama. I like to be inside the movie, but at least one screen width away. So if you have a 10-foot wide screen, you ought to be able to sit 10 feet away. And then the question is, what projector is going to fill that size screen? And that's largely a matter, I think, of how much light can you afford to throw on the screen? And the most important factor there is having a completely blacked out room so that you don't have any light straying in and competing with the image on the screen. At which point, there are some really great candidates out there by any number of companies, including Epson, Panasonic, BenQ, and I'm sure I can mention some others, but the salient factors are to look for actual light output in whatever review you're perusing that says this is the greatest projector since the wheel, because eventually it's going to be replaced by something else that probably has the same light output, but other characteristics that are better, like better color or better contrast. And also the major factor, I think, is actual resolution on screen. So it can be a 1080p projector, and you can have a crappy plastic lens that just throws that resolution away. So if you're sitting far enough away from the screen, definitely more than one screen width, you probably won't notice the difference. And you don't need to spend extra money on that expensive lens. But if you're like me and you want to be more immersive, you'll sit closer to the bigger screen, and then you want to have a really good lens on your decent projector that you already have evaluated and found four or five reviews that say, gosh, I really like this projector. It looked just, you know, just like I was there. And you would be satisfied. And that honestly can happen for as little as $1,000 if the screen is the right size.
I usually tend to recommend spending $2,000 to $3,000, and Epson is probably my favorite brand, or JVC.
Sure. I think they both, again, have certain visual characteristics, which are a part of either the LCD or the, I'm sorry, which was the other projector that you mentioned?
JVC.
Sure. So, you know, two different variations on liquid crystals, just as SXRD is the liquid crystal variation of Sony's. I'm a big, big fan of DLP because essentially it's just a first surface mirror and the light information source for each pixel.
Right. So essentially, but the only problem there is that DLP projectors are now available mostly either as really inexpensive and therefore not perhaps performing as well or being able to fill up as big a screen, or relatively expensive, like in the $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000 range and up, way up from there. We only have another just quick second to go here. In terms of sound, obviously, in terms of immersion, we'd want 5.1 at least, 7.1 to have a little more around you. There's you could also put height speakers. Now, some receivers let you put speakers up high in the front, which give you a sense of a little bit of 3D or hemispherical sound. But there's no home version of Dolby Atmos or Oro yet. DTS Neo X gives you that height sense. Also, Dolby 2Z, ProLogic 2Z, gives you those height speakers. Odyssey DSX is another system. So you'd want to look for a receiver that has those features in it if you wanted to get those height channels.
Definitely something for people to work on after they've already established a really solid foundation in a home theater. Again, with, I think, a substantial size screen, darkened room, good solid projector, and at the same time a basic surround sound system, which at least has to have the 5.1 channels. And without that 0.1, you're really missing the bottom two octaves that are in the mix, which essentially brings it back to headphones from my standpoint.
Right. But you definitely want a system with a subwoofer to get those low octaves, which also gives you a greater sense of immersion as well. Well, you know what? Absolutely. We've run out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being here on the show. Fascinating discussion about the past, present, and future of cinema and movies and home theater. Thanks so much, Jeremy Kipnis.
I loved it. Thanks again. I look forward to it in the future. And please come to my website, send me an email, ask me any of your questions. I'd be very happy to answer them.
You bet. That website is Kipnis, Kipnis-studios.com. And you're also a blogger at theosroundtable.com. That's Theo Kalamarakis' website, a very well-known theater designer. Just wanted to make sure everybody knew that as well. You can find me, of course, at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott, also at avsforum. You can also find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here at twit.tv/htg and our YouTube channel, youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be John Schuerman, a consultant for Panamorph. And we're going to be talking all about anamorphic lenses and ultra-wide screen projection in the home. It's a very interesting subject that a lot of people want to know more about, and there's a lot of confusion out there. So we are going to try to dispel much of that confusion next week. So I do hope you will join me. Until then, geek out.